For the week of July 26th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 288, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in upstate New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Oh, wait, I just came from upstate New York. Where are you?
I'm in Montgomery, New York, a Chekhovian estate near Beacon, New York, perhaps. That helps you, about 80 minutes north of Manhattan, staying at a friend's lovely restored home for a week or two.
I know where that is, and I was nowhere near there.
But the question is, where will you be next week?
I will be in Maui, Hawaii.
Gorgeous Hawaii. That's
yes.
Right. I'm couch surfing, and you're going to be vacationing in Hawaii, which means no show next week because of you.
Pretty much, yes. It's all because of me. At least people keep telling me that.
I hope our fans don't say aloha to the show and us with this, you know, scattershot schedule that we have right now.
Aha. If they do, they would be saying hello and goodbye.
Or goodbye.
And welcome. And
as Cameron Crowe has learned.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, we've got them here. We weren't here last week. We won't be here next week, but we will be back on after that as the fall kicks into high gear. Hopefully it'll be fall then. No, it'll still be summer, right? It'll be mid-August. So we'll be around. We'll be doing shows more regularly then. But the question is, right now, this week, while people are here and still listening to the show, what will we be talking about?
Are they still listening, really?
I mean, yes, keep going.
Okay, well, if they are still listening, then what is going on, Michael? It's the middle of summer. Nothing is supposed to be happening. But instead, there is so much entertainment news from the past 2 weeks, it's hard to know even where to start. The summer box office, it continues to rake in big bucks around the world, not just in North America.
You sound angry.
I'm not angry.
Okay.
But yeah, and how could you be angry when the box office is making so much money, except for maybe that new Adam Sandler movie? Or did it make money? That might be because North American moviegoers are now paying record ticket prices. Just ask IMAX, who is benefiting from the BAFO box office. They'd be happy to give you an answer if you ask them if they weren't too busy celebrating the highest quarterly earnings in the company's history. The European Union is no happier with their cable company than you or me, but they have the power to do something about it, and thus, they are suing six Hollywood studios. We'll tell you why. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Somebody had coffee this morning.
As a matter of fact, I did. How did you know? I mean, is it that obvious?
So we're looking at box office around the world. We get our information from RentTrak. We've got a link in our show notes, and we pull info from all the other sites. You know them, you love them. The number one movie around the world is Minions. It grossed $66 million over the weekend. It's at $760 million worldwide. It's basically doubling its U.S. box office overseas, but it's a big hit here in North America, $260 million in the U.S., another $500 million overseas. That's how it gets to $760 million worldwide, and it's not done yet.
I mean, $760 million worldwide. That is a lot of money. It's close to $1 billion.
It's 3/4 of the way there. It's got $250 million to go. But again, if you look at Despicable Me 1 and 2, this is kind of where they would hope the movie would land. It used to be sequels declined one after the other, but we're in this new world we live in. Like every sequel in a franchise is expected to make the same amount of money or more. You know, the Fast and Furious franchise is a crazy example of that, where almost every film made more than the one before. And here we've got Minions, a spinoff of Despicable Me. 30, 40, 50 years ago, they would think, well, we'll make that low budget. It's not going to make a lot of money. It's just, you know, trying to squeeze the franchise dry. But in this case, they're looking to make just as much money as the original.
Well, it most certainly will. Plus all of that merchandising. That's really where the money is in this, in my opinion.
Well, that's right. Sure. Absolutely. At number two around the world is Ant-Man. And again, is this merchandising? No, but it is part of the Marvel universe. So when you judge how successful is this film, how well is it going to do? There's a lot of things to take into account. It opened last weekend, right?
Yes, it did. And I don't know why you say that this wouldn't be merchandising. They made a ton of merchandise for this movie. You just can't see it. You need a microscope.
It grossed $60 million worldwide this weekend. It's at $225 million and counting. Now, Ant-Man was a pretty pricey movie, right? It won the weekend here in North America. It cost about $130 million to make, which means they need to hit $400 million, probably, roughly, to get into profitability. There's a couple good things going on with this movie. It got pretty good reviews. Audiences seem to like it. So it may get to that $400 million mark. It's tracking sort of like the first Captain America, doing a little better than the Hulk, which was a disaster. they think fans lost interest more quickly than they expected here in North America. Maybe it'll do better overseas, but they made a decent movie, and that really helps a lot, frankly, doesn't it? As far as the long-term value of the Marvel Universe, you're going to have Ant-Man in an Avengers movie. You're going to have Ant-Man pop up elsewhere. So you want to make sure the movie doesn't suck.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I know you have.
I thought it was pretty good. Better than most of the Marvel movies I've seen recently. It's not great, but it's a pretty good movie. It's light, kind of like Iron Man, the first Iron Man. It's light, it's sort of fun and flippant, and it has a very charming lead performance. In this case, of course, Paul Rudd.
Yeah, you know, this spurred, of course, this would be much better, George R.R. Martin. It spurred him to say that, you know, he's liking the movies, but he doesn't like the villains, and it's time for Marvel to get better villains, to which HBO said, get back to work. Keep writing.
They're going to finish the series without him. They don't care if he finishes the books. Yeah, no, he has he's appearing. Where is he appearing? In Jersey? He's in Jersey or Long Island, I think, for some event, because he grew up seeing the skyline from his home there. And that inspired Game of Thrones. And he's at some film festival or doing something. And I know fans are like, why aren't he's doing a, that's it. He's doing a signing at the Staten Island Yankees in Staten Island, because the skyline of the city from Staten Island is what inspired his vision of the big cities in Game of Thrones. And he's going to be there at a minor league ball club doing a book signing. It's cool. He should be able to do it. He can write it that morning before he goes, and he can write that night when he gets home. But I know fans are like, get to work. Why aren't you working? Write the books. We've gotten way off track here. Yeah. Here's the big news. Mm-hmm.
That's very true. We have.
Yeah. Here's the big news in box office. Monster Hunt.
What?
Now, if you're in North America, you haven't heard of it, but Monster Hunt is a Chinese film. It's a 3D adventure, and they're loving 3D in China right now. And it made $46 million over the weekend. It's made $211 million worldwide. It's become a monster hit in China. This has been a really big smash hit film. It's the highest grossing Chinese film in history after just 2 weeks. Now, the highest grossing film overall.
Well, we should say that there's also a little bit of and I don't want to say an embargo, but a blackout.
We've talked before that China has certain parts of the year where they black out competition. They won't let Hollywood movies open up. They don't let them even play in the theater, really. That's why they were yanking some movies, you know, 2 weekends ago to make way for the Chinese films. Nonetheless, It's a big smash hit. It's the highest grossing Chinese film in history. That doesn't happen just because there are no Hollywood films opening up. If a movie's not good, people won't go. Now, it's at $211 million. The biggest film of all time in China is Fast and Furious 7, which hit almost $400 million. But what's really interesting about this movie to me is that it's directed by Ramen Hui. I don't know how to say his name. I apologize, Mr.
Ramen Hui.
Ramen Hui. He was a key animator on the original Shrek film. He might have been the guy in charge of animation. I'm not, you know, his title is a little unclear, but he was mentioned in The Hollywood Reporter as being the creator of Shrek, meaning the look and the style of that particular character. So he's a big player in the original Shrek film, and he has since then gone on to work his way up the food chain the way you do. He directed some shorts. He co-directed Shrek the Third. And of course, the next logical step after that, and he did a few other shorts after that, a number of them in the Shrek franchise, the next step is to direct your own big budget movie on your own. And he did that. But instead of doing that in Hollywood, where he'd been born and raised, and, you know, talent-wise, he did it in China. China reached out to him, got him to make a movie in China, and it's proven a big smash hit. Now, that he may jump back to Hollywood for his next movie. Maybe China will just offer him the freedom and inducements that he wants to keep making films for them. It's just, to me, that's really where you're talking about competition. Because in the old days, someone would become a big success in Hong Kong and Hollywood snapped them up. Or be a big success in France. And if Hollywood thought this person has commercial instincts, they'd snap them up. World War II sent a bunch of people to Hollywood. Now we have people going to China in order to get their opportunity. And that, to me, is a really notable change. You've got big Hollywood stars appearing in Chinese films. You've got major Hollywood talent that has worked their way up the food chain and is ready to swing the bat for a big hit. And they're doing it not in the U.S., but they're doing it in China.
Well, while Ramen Hui is making a big name for himself and kind of on the rise, our next film actually has somebody who might be on the decline.
Oh, that's Adam Sandler. It's Pixels. His movie opened up over the weekend. It made $45 million worldwide. It's at about $50 million and counting. And of course, people say, oh, Adam Sandler's career is over. He's trash. He's terrible. He's awful. Everybody hates him. It didn't open at number one over the weekend. But does that matter? Well,
in this case,
do bragging rights matter?
Well, only in so much as for a week you get to advertise to it. You know, the number one movie in America. There's, I'm sure, some executive pay linked to it, and maybe some bonuses linked to it. But at the end of the day, what you're going to look at is how much money did the movie cost to make? What did it cost to produce? And how much money is it bringing in? Is it basically going to be in the black? This movie costs roughly $88, $89, $90 million to make. I don't know if that's actually true, but at least that's the reported budget. And it made, you know, a quarter of that over the weekend.
Well, no, it made half of that worldwide.
Oh, worldwide. Sorry. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Worldwide.
It's made $50 million since it opened up. So that's a good start towards profitability. It needs to get to $250 million, maybe $270. Perhaps, roughly. We don't know what Adam Sandler's deal is. Nobody does. We don't know what the actual budget is. We can only go on the numbers we have, which we think is about $90 million to make. He probably gets a bigger piece at the back end. So you're going to have to make at least $270 million, maybe $300 million to say nobody's losing their shirt. Bad reviews.
I don't know this movie's going to do that. I just don't think it will.
But that's what matters, not whether it opens up at number one.
True.
Right. So that's where it's at. Does he do better overseas? I don't know. It is a flashy movie with a good, strong visual hook to it. So perhaps that will play better than other Adam Sandler comedies, because comedies are notoriously don't play well in other territories. But I think he has actually a pretty good track record overseas. But maybe I'm wrong about that. So the question is, where does it end up? You know, it was a good concept, a good idea. A lot of critics praised the concept of the movie, but said it was just a bad script and a bad, lazy film. And they've all said his career's over, which is stupid, right?
Well, again, the definition of a star is somebody who can actually rise once, fall, and then rise again. Just ask John Travolta.
I don't know if that's the definition of a star. That's one example of a star. You know, you have a long career. There will be ups and downs. Other people are successful on and on and on and on. You know, that's an enduring star, you know. But yeah, you're a star. But good. This guy's been popular for 30 years, right?
Yes.
I mean, he started in the late 80s on The Cosby Show. You know, he had a little small recurring role in that. And then, of course, Saturday Night Live. And he's never looked back. He's had ups and he's had downs. But he's been pretty consistently profitable and successful for people that work with him. So, you know, the idea that he's washed up and done. Well, yeah, he's made a lot of bad movies recently. Hasn't made a fun film. But a lot of them have actually made money, even if they weren't very good. And to rule him out just because he's had a couple bad hits in a row is dumb. You know, after 30 years, he's not going to disappear. You know, he's got four movies lined up with Netflix. The first one got some bad press. Maybe he'll be inspired and pushed to, you know, do a better job on the next one. So don't rule Adam Sandler out just because he's made a couple bad movies. It's dumb. When you've had a 30-year career, you're not washed up because of one movie. At number five around the world. Oh, but that reminds me, advertising. You mentioned the advertising. Oh, you get to advertise it for a week. You probably meant TV.
Yes.
Right.
Only TV.
So advertising, we mentioned that a minute ago, and I've just noticed for the first time, it's been going on for a while. I'm sure it's not a new phenomenon. It's been happening slowly for years. But if you look at the print edition of the New York Times, you don't see ads for big Hollywood movies. What you see ads for are the art house films that sort of need attention, or they know that the people reading the print edition of the New York Times are more likely to be there than somewhere else. And so you will see ads for like the Woody Allen movie or art house films, but what you don't see ads for are big Hollywood movies. And I've looked over like a month or two of back issues, and it's pretty consistent. Basically, studios don't put print ads in newspapers anymore.
No, and actually I could save you some time. They don't. They literally, you can go back 2, 3, maybe even 4 years. They are not advertising in, you know, with these big ads in the newspaper because
right, maybe for like a fall movie preview or once or a couple times a year they'll do it, but that's about it. I mean, it's not that they absolutely never do, but basically they're not in that business anymore.
That's right, which is why everybody who was criticizing the LA Times for letting the Minions, in their... it's not a masthead. What is it?
In the nameplate.
There was a big outcry over that. And yet, whatever, you know, others were pointing out is, look, you know what? At least Universal Pictures was purchasing. Yeah.
So then I said, well, gee, they must be doing it online because that's where the kids are. So I went to the New York Times website and I went to some other websites of newspapers and I didn't see any ads for big studio films there. Maybe it's because of me. And they knew who I was, so they geared the ads towards me. But looking over a number of sites in a number of different ways, I saw ads again for art house films. So you would think maybe the money migrated online. I didn't see it. I did not see ads on the websites for major studio films at the major newspapers. So I don't think the money's even going there.
I don't think it is either. It's television.
It's TV and I guess radio maybe. And yeah. So I found that very interesting. It doesn't surprise me at all. I'm sure if you'd asked me and what did I think was happening, I would have said, well, probably that. But to see it actually done and like they don't advertise in newspapers or even newspaper websites anymore, despite the ton of traffic those get, that's kind of interesting.
They're advertising on IMDb, Fandango, you know, IGN, basically where they think that eyeballs, you know, where they're trying to build awareness, basically.
Right. And they tried to build awareness for Pixels. It opened up. Adam Sandler got people in the seats for the first day, right? $25 million, not a lot. He didn't win the weekend. It's one of his lower openings for a big film like this. But, you know, we'll see where it ends up. Probably won't be a great story, but to rule out his career is a little silly. But at number five is a film that's doing great, and that's Inside Out. That is the Pixar film. It's grossed a massive $320 million in North America. It's really done well. So it's got a lot to do overseas to catch up to that, and it probably will. Right now, this weekend, it made $35 million. It's at $550 million and counting, which means it's profitable.
Yeah.
Right? That's just about where it's gotten to because it's a very expensive film. It costs like $175 million to make. But this is another strong entry to the library of Pixar. At number six, again, we've had this two-week period where a lot of big Chinese films opened up. It's like their summer vacation, their Hollywood blackout period. So a number of big films have been opening up. The second one is Jian Bing Man or Pancake Man. This is a Chinese comedy. It grossed $25 million. It's at $130 million and counting. At number seven is another film that's a big North American release. It's Paper Towns. This is a film that opened up at like, what, number five for the weekend?
I believe so, yes, in North America.
No, number six in North America. But who cares? It costs $12 million to make. It's based on a novel about teens by John Green, who is this generation's Judy Blume, or I don't know what to call him. But he's a very successful young adult author. He, of course, wrote The Fault in Our Stars, which was a once-in-a-lifetime phenomenon. So comparing the grosses of this movie to that movie is dumb. But looking at what it cost, which was $12 million, and finding out that it made $20 million over the weekend and is at just under $30 million and counting worldwide, well, they're in great shape, obviously. They've more than doubled their box office, their budget on opening weekend. So, you know, Paper Towns is going to be a profitable film for Fox. And number eight is Southpaw. And this is another example of Harvey Weinstein's marketing. He doesn't need to take out print ads, does he? What he needs to do is talk up a film. And in this case, he said, Jake Gyllenhaal is going to win the Oscar for this movie. Even though it's a piece of junk movie, they released it in the summer rather than the fall. It got pretty bad reviews. Everybody thought Jake was okay, but the movie got poor reviews. Nobody really likes it, but it did okay at the box office because, you know, Harvey Weinstein knows how to sell a movie. It made $20 million over the weekend. It will not be remembered come Oscar time. But
it's hardly remembered right now.
Right. But good for Harvey to, you know, get some buzz for his movie and, you know, angrily talk about how Jake Gyllenhaal did get robbed for Nightcrawlers, which was a terrific film and should have gotten Oscar nominations, and sort of take on the glow of that movie for this movie, which is a boxing flick, pretty retro, pretty by the numbers B movie, but some good actors in it. Not a terrific film, but it opened up okay. And number nine is Assassination. This is a South Korean period action film. It grossed $19 million over the weekend, and it's at $23 million and counting. Well, it's set during the 30s when Japan occupied South Korea. So I'm guessing the box office for Assassination won't be strong in Japan.
Probably not.
I'm guessing they probably won't open up that film in Japan. But here's another big director to talk about. This is not an American going to China. This is a South Korean director, but he's really grown bigger and bigger with every film. His name is Choi Dong-hoon. This is his fifth movie. It's his fifth hit. And so far, each one has been bigger than the one before. Most recently, he directed Thieves, which was the second biggest Korean film of all time. It sold 12.9 million tickets. And ooh, do I love getting ticket sales as opposed to box office. I wish everybody would switch to that. It remains the second biggest film of all time. The biggest, of course, is The Host, a film that crossed over here in North America and did quite well. So I think it's only a matter of time before, you know, just as China poached some Hollywood directors, someone in Hollywood has probably already approached Choi Dong-hoon, who makes very commercial, very fun movies. In this case, it's about a team of operatives led by women who are sent in to assassinate the head of the Japanese troops that are occupying South Korea. So that's their mission. It looks fun. It's a big, fun movie. It's made a lot of money on opening weekend. It looks like another big success story for Choi Dong-hoon. And I wouldn't be surprised if he's interested if he made the crossover to Hollywood, just like John Woo and so many others have done before.
Now, is there a character in the film that yells, "Get back to the choppa"?
I don't believe so.
Okay, just checking.
Okay.
Because number 10 that's my Arnold Schwarzenegger joke for the show.
Yes, well, thank you. We need one a week. At number 10, or perhaps you'll do two since you were off last week.
Okay. I'll see if I can find one.
Thank you. At number 10 is Trainwreck, the Amy Schumer film, which was marred in the media by another horrible gun shooting that happened in a theater here in the U.S. I think it was Louisville.
Louisville? Oh, my gosh. No, it was in Louisiana.
It was in Louisiana. What city was it?
Lafayette, Louisiana. And, you know, it's an unfortunate thing.
Unfortunate. That's one word for it.
Yeah. Well, it's horrible. It's a tragedy. And we're not covering it necessarily because it's a hard news event and there's not much to say other than, you know, gun control.
Though, of course, Hollywood's perspective, of course, is always, will it affect the box office? And it doesn't seem to have. Isn't that a tacky, terrible thing to talk about? But that's naturally when you're in the industry, what happens? You know, the last time this happened, I believe it was Dark Knight Returns.
Yes.
And people talked about how suddenly that movie was constantly being referenced as somehow, because it was, I think, a violent film, whereas Trainwreck, I don't think it's sticking in people's mind. It just was a movie theater shooting, not a shooting at Trainwreck. I don't think that has really, the two have not become linked the way they were with Dark Knight Returns, because that was a more nihilistic, dark, violent film.
Plus, this guy who did it was dressed as the Joker, so that kind of...
that did sort of tie it in a bit. In this case, the guy was not dressed as Amy Schumer. He's just an idiotic loser who happily killed himself at the end of it, or maybe he was shot dead. I don't know.
No, he turned the gun on himself.
Well, thank God for that. Too bad he didn't do that at home before we went out to see a movie. So the film grossed $17 million over the weekend. It's at $60 million and counting. It certainly counts as a triumph for Amy Schumer. She wrote it. She stars in it. She made the leap from TV to movies as, you know, a leading lady. So good for her.
Yeah, no, she's having a heck of a year.
At number 11 is another Chinese film. This is a Chinese animated film, Monkey King. We've talked about it before. Another $17 million. It's about to pass the $100 million mark. Number 12 is Jurassic World. It Won't Stop. Another $14 million. $1,540,000,000. And yes, you can ring the bell. Jurassic World is now the third biggest film worldwide of all time. It passes The Avengers, which had $1,522,000,000. And the only two movies ahead of it are both past the $2 billion mark. It ain't going to get there. So Avatar will remain the number one film of all time, and Titanic will remain number two. Both of those grossed over $2 billion. This movie is at $1.5 billion. It's a monster hit. And of course, to our shock, they have now greenlit two sequels.
I know. And both of which, the first coming out in 2018, and will star both Chris Pratt and, why am I forgetting her name? Dallas Howard.
Mm-hmm. Dallas Bryce Howard, no?
Yes, sorry. Dallas Bryce.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, or Bryce Dallas Howard. You know what? It's starring the redhead.
Nice. Very nice. And you wonder why women aren't getting ahead in Hollywood. Executives like Sperling.
Well, look, so, I couldn't remember George R. R. Martin's name earlier either.
That's true. But anyway, this massive hit, they've made two sequels. My only question is, why not three? You know, why don't they turn the last sequel into two movies like they always do? I'm just surprised they only announced two of them. It's such a monster hit. And the funny thing was the piracy story. Universal found somebody hosting a pirated copy of Jurassic World on their computers, and they went out to, where did they go? To do they go to the MPAA, or do they go to the FCC, or do they go to Internet World and say, hey, you need to block that pirated copy of Jurassic World. That's terrible. That's wrong. Where is that located?
It's located at Universal Pictures France. And actually, they were contacting Google with a takedown notice saying, here you go, Google, take down all of these links because they all go to pirated copies of Jurassic World, including this one right here, which is, whoa, that's in Paris. That's our address. Basically, there's some thinking here that one, that link actually probably did not actually go to a server inside Universal Pictures in France, or two, that it was set up as a honeypot to get IP addresses of people who were downloading and possibly spreading the pirated copies around.
Oh, that's funny. My assumption was that it was a zombie computer, that they didn't realize that computers get seeded with, you know, porn and other things that are in the background and people don't know it. And yet they're suddenly serving as a sort of a server or host for pirated material. And they don't even realize that it's on their computer because it gets downloaded on their computer in the background. And then people upload it from that computer, even though the person themselves is utterly innocent of any wrongdoing.
Right.
That happens a lot too, doesn't it?
Less and less, but yes, there, you know, the whole bot thing is a problem.
Oh, why does it happen less and less?
Well, because, you know, the holes are closing, people are closing holes, but yes, I would say, you know,
the holes are closing. I don't know what that means.
Oh, the software, the operating system, the holes in the operating system.
It's a little better. The computers now don't go out unless you want it to.
Well, and as people upgrade their operating systems, a lot of times that it takes care of that a little bit, but yeah, some of the older systems are absolutely completely botted up.
All right. Well, skipping down the charts, Terminator Genesis is still trudging along $300 million worldwide. It doesn't look like it's going to get to profitability, but we'll have to see. Magic Mike, that crossed the $100 million mark. So that's certainly a success story because the movie cost $15 million to make. Here's a weird thing. We should probably save this for later when we get to the Cars ripoff. But this is Only You. It's a Chinese romantic comedy. It opened pretty weakly at $7 million. I don't know what the budget is, so I shouldn't say that. But with all those other movies making so much money, it looks a little bit to have been overshadowed. But it's called Only You. And of course, I looked up to see what's the film. And it's a remake of the Robert Downey Jr. Marissa Tomei movie, Only You, which was a box office slop. Why are you remaking that movie?
I don't know. Yeah, that's true. Maybe they wanted to see if it would work in China. I don't know.
Yeah. And way down at the bottom at number 18 on this list of Rentrak's big movies of the week is Seer 5, S-E-E-R, C, like profit, Seer 5 Quake Rise. It grossed $4 million over the weekend. It grossed $6 million worldwide so far. I have no idea what it is. I found an Italian horror film called The Seer, but this is Seer number 5, and I just couldn't find any. It's apparently China, because it looks like it has a Chinese distributor. But what's it about? What Seer 1 through 4 were about? Why they're still making them? I don't know.
If you do know, write to dirt@showbizsandbox.com and let us know. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
That's right. And I did finally meet someone who really liked Jurassic World. I've been saying for a while, I haven't met anyone. Well, the guy in my mailbox, he and his kids liked it. He said, it just, you know, it moved. It never stopped. There were no pauses. It just kept going and going and going. I liked it. It was really great. I go, compared to the original, yeah, it was really good.
Yeah, it moved right past the story, in fact. It forgot to pick it up on the way.
So opening this week, at least in North America and in some cases around the world, of course, Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, a new Tom Cruise film. He's looking for a hit, and it's getting good reviews from the trade, so we'll have to see what happens. And Vacation with Ed Helms and Christina Applegate.
People love
the trailer for this movie. They love it.
I was going to say, if it's half as good as not only the trailer, but the stuff they showed at CinemaCon, this is going to be a big hit. It was really funny.
P.J. O'Rourke, who got his start at National Lampoon and has gone on to become a successful writer and commentator, he was bemoaning this movie. He thought it looked so witless and dumb, especially compared to the original, and how it just drove the franchise into the ground. And he was laughing really at the fact that they don't even play up the National Lampoon angle. Like it used to be that was a really valuable thing to slap on a movie, National Lampoon's Vacation. Now they don't even, they're kind of embarrassed by that, or they don't even bother mentioning it. So it's the end of an era as far as P.J. O'Rourke is concerned.
That's like saying the Saturday Evening Post's, you know, whatever. It's like it doesn't exist anymore. So why would you put it? I mean, it does, but not the way it used to. Why would you do that? Why would you, put the name of some vaudeville theater on your movie when nobody even knows who it is?
And in indie releases, we've got two big movies. The first is Best of Enemies. I really want to see this. It's a documentary about the 1968 televised debates between Gore Vidal on the left and William F. Buckley Jr. on the right. I predict right now that all the reviewers will say, for the days when TV had thoughtful, substantive conversation like this. Oh, those days are gone.
Well, I can tell you that this movie was at Sundance, as was the end of the tour, which you're about to talk about. And it was one of the most buzzed about films from this past year. People really liked it.
Oh, well, yeah, it just looks very fun. Gore Vidal and Buckley are very entertaining, so I do want to check that out. And then there is the end of the tour. Now, Harvey Weinstein wanted to talk up Jake Gyllenhaal, a great actor, as being worthy of an Oscar nomination for Southpaw, or actually an Oscar statue. He said, he's going to win. I'm going to make him win. In this case, we've got a movie about a Rolling Stone journalist interviewing writer David Foster Wallace, and this really will perhaps be in the Oscar talk. It stars Jason Segel as David Foster Wallace and Jesse Eisenberg as the journalist. And Jason Segel, what a fascinating career he's had. I mean, big Dork in Freaks and Geeks to How I Met Your Mother, a really successful sitcom where he was one of the stars. Then he rebooted The Muppets. That's a huge accomplishment. And now he's got a very serious dramatic role in this movie. So what a career turnaround. Not a turnaround, but what an interesting, varied career for Jason Segel.
Well, certainly when people go see it, they will probably be paying a little bit more than they're used to, at least if they see it during the summer.
What do you mean? Why is it in 3D?
Ah, no. Well, I don't know. Actually, maybe it's not. It's not. Uh-huh. This was a film. You know, it's an independent film. It's a drama. It's not a 3D. But this was my way of moving us onto the story about how ticket prices, movie ticket prices, the average ticket price in North America hit a record high in the second
Yay!
Quarter. Yeah, well, $8.61 U.S.
Wow. So globally, well, I don't think that's the case. We've been having some stories recently about prices and averages going down in some markets. So that's kind of interesting that in North America, it still continues to rise. This is the average for the second quarter. So for the year overall, we'll have to see where we end up. This is summertime when you do have some very successful movies in 3D. Jurassic World has proven a big success and people wanted to see that movie in 3D. So that makes a difference. You know, so thank you, IMAX, and thank you, 3D, and thank you, premium price screens. You've managed to raise the average ticket price.
Yeah, I guess in the past, 2013 had, the high for the second quarter of $8.38. This year, it's $8.61.
Is that a record for the second quarter? Is that a record for any quarter?
It's the record for the second quarter, and probably any quarter, because ticket prices are generally higher right now in the second quarter and in the fourth quarter for the Christmas holiday season.
Interesting. And so IMAX is raking in the bucks, aren't they?
Yeah, they're pretty much, if you can't reach them, they're in the back counting all their money. They basically had a record quarter. I guess what? They grossed $107 million thanks to, did Jurassic World itself make $107 million?
No,
it couldn't have. So it was Jurassic World, The Avengers, Avengers Age of Ultron, and Furious 7. All
for some of the big hits.
Yeah, $107 million in ticket sales in the last quarter.
No. No, IMAX screens generated $343 million in box office. The company itself grossed $107 million. So they're at almost $350 million for the quarter. That was how much money IMAX screens generated in the second quarter. And they themselves pulled back $107 million. So their revenue
their
of $107 million is the biggest quarter of revenue in IMAX history. So where are they at? I mean, how many IMAX screens are there, by the way?
Well, they have 976 IMAX branded theaters around the world. 391 are kind of in the pipeline. They're still trying to be built or they're contracted. And they have 30 new locations signed up for new ones.
So, what's the difference between the 30 location, the new ones, and the 391 backlog? Like they're already paid for and done, and they just haven't even started?
Or that they're in places where there was never an IMAX screen. The city itself, the geographic location, did not have an IMAX screen. Not across town. Not in the city anywhere.
So if you've got a movie and you want to show it in IMAX, you can open on 1,000 screens worldwide.
Yes. My question is, how many of these are actually IMAX and how many are FIMAX or LIMAX or whatever you want to call them?
Brand. But of course, now the IMAX brand does not mean IMAX. It does not mean that 10-story tall picture and shot with an IMAX camera. Now IMAX just means a really big screen, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's gone. The idea of IMAX meaning IMAX, we just have to get over it, right? Because now it just means, oh, it's a really big screen. No, it wasn't shot in IMAX. No, it's not an actual IMAX screen of that certain dimension. It's just a big screen with good picture and sound. And people will pay extra for it, even if the movie wasn't shot in IMAX, even if the movie isn't being shown in IMAX. They just like the IMAX brand, and they're saying, all right, yeah, I'll pay extra for that.
Yeah, and I think that some of these movie theaters, like AMC's, the Regal, some of these chains which are doing the premium and screens,
right,
their own brand, so to speak, the ETX or, mm-hmm. it's the problem is that IMAX has, several decade head start on branding. So, people.
Are they not working?
I don't necessarily know. I think they probably are. But IMAX certainly is, far and away.
Beat.
Yeah, it's definitely, the poster child, if you will.
Well, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but you were gone. We missed the Emmy nominations. I feel like it's not even worth talking about anymore.
First of all, here's the thing. I don't think any of the shows that were nominated for Emmys have dead horses in them. So I don't know where the dead horse would come into play.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. None of them. Downton Abbey maybe had a horse. I don't know.
They might have.
But, you know, we still, there were some, I mean, were you happy at least
there
with
was,
the nominations?
There was a UK show called Drop the Dead Donkey, by the way. That's as close as I could come to a dead horse. There was a sitcom, I think it was in the 70s. I'm not sure about that, but called, no, it was in the 90s. Drop the Dead Donkey. And it was a media sitcom, you know, about kind of like a Rupert Murdoch type world. But
and,
anyway.
And it's probably now, you know, Stranger Than Fiction, I'm sure.
That's or right. Truth. Yeah. Yes. So what happened at the Emmy nominations? I'll tell you what happened. I can tell it all in 5 seconds. Some shows got nominated and shouldn't have been. Other shows didn't get nominated and should have been. Some actors got nominations and shouldn't have. And other actors didn't get nominations and they should have. Come back at the Emmys to find out who wins.
Okay, so do I even want to know, well, okay, which shows got nominated but shouldn't have been?
Well, no, we're not going to go through that. Like, that's just what all the coverage amounted to.
Oh, okay. So we're talking about what the coverage said. Yeah, pretty much. I mean,
yeah,
this year, for some reason, and maybe it's because all of a sudden, it used to be you had the networks versus the premium cable, HBOs and Showtimes. Then it was the networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, the broadcast networks versus the premium cable versus the cable networks, the AMC, basic cable. Now there's a fourth player, and that is all these streaming services. So literally the amount of mail in my mailbox with four-year consideration for Emmys has never been higher.
Do you get screeners?
Not screeners, just... because, you know, there's only the one show that they can nominate for certain things. But it's more just, you know, lots of postcards and flyers. And
but you're not a voter, are you?
I'm not a voter. I don't know what they're doing. Please stop sending me all this stuff. And they do it in the Hollywood Reporter and the Variety. All the print editions are filled with them and they come with the special issues. It's just like, my God, enough. You'd think this was the Oscars. And even the Oscars is too much.
Yeah, this really is the big story. Major networks are being just shut out of the Emmys. They're barely a player anymore. If you look at outstanding drama, outstanding comedy, outstanding limited run series, the networks are just not involved. They're not there. There is no network drama up for best drama. There are two network comedies up for best comedy. Parks and Recreation, which is saying goodbye, and Modern Family, which should not have been nominated and is on its final legs practically. I'm sure they've got another few years going, but really, you know. So, I mean, they're not even players anymore when it comes to drama and comedy. They're not play. They haven't been a player for limited series or movies for ages. And variety sketch shows, you know, they've got Saturday Night Live, and that's about it, keeping the lights on. So major networks, you know, they're not in the awards game anymore, are they?
No, not at all. But I was very happy to see the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt nominated. I was very happy to see Silicon Valley nominated for both of which for Outstanding Comedy Series. I wonder if Parks and Recreation won't win just because, A, it's a broadcast show, so it's from the broadcast.
Well, I don't think that's a negative, do you? Did you say it won't or will win? I thought you said it won't win because it's a broadcast show.
No, will win.
Oh, will win. Oh, so, well, because all the other networks will be like, well, let's at least pick one of our own.
Yeah. I think the networks will get behind
it. Modern Family won't win again? Good God.
Oh, God, if that wins again, then people literally are just like marking with, you know, with a dart. I don't know how they would mark their ballots otherwise. But it's the last, you know, it's you either anoint a new show as kind of like a madman and, you know, or you say goodbye to a show by giving it, you know, an outstanding comedy series or drama series on the way out. And I think Parks and Rec might get that this year.
Yeah, they certainly could. But Louie had a great year.
It did.
Transparent is the, you know, is the, I've a lot of people, that's Amazon, right?
Yes, it is. And that might be the one to beat, by the way.
Yeah, that's got a terrific lead male performance. People keep talking to me about it. Like people who are not aggressive TV, like, oh, did you watch Transparent? Oh, I really liked it, you know. So people are watching that show and finding it. So that's, to me, very, when people suddenly start mentioning it a lot. Some friends just started binge watching Veep, the Julia Louis-Dreyfus television series. My God, I finally said her name right.
You know what? It's funny because when the nominations were announced, the reporter on NPR who had to say it actually stumbled over it. And I thought to myself, that is so funny. Nobody can say her name.
Well, she can.
Well, true.
And she deserves it. She's been a big star for like 20. She's like, learn my name already. It's been 25 years. You know, it's time you learned my name. Fair enough. So, you know, we'll have to see. It's a very competitive category. Parks and Recreation was never a big hit and never really even had the buzz, I don't think, that like Transparent or Louie has a sense of a buzzworthy cutting edge show, but it is beloved. It is got its own funky little sensibility. It may very well just go by unnoticed, but you know, that's the sort of thing you watch for when you're watching the Emmys. And I want to see who's going to win best talk show.
Best talk show. Okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, Letterman is saying goodbye. Stephen Colbert is saying goodbye. Jon Stewart is saying goodbye. Who gets the parting gift?
I think you'd have to give it to Letterman, right? I mean, he's been doing it for eons.
I mean, I would hope so, but I have no, I wouldn't think it's a given whatsoever. He's barely been nominated in years. You know, he hasn't been nominated in a number of years. So the nomination may be as much as he gets to say goodbye. If you want to look at the weakness, you know, Stewart's won it again and again and again. Colbert deserves it, you know, as far as, you know, hot new show and walking away at the peak. But yeah, Letterman, if you look at the 35-year career, clearly, that would be the one I would vote for.
Well, speaking of hot new shows, it's not necessarily new, necessarily. It's like about a year or two old. Inside Amy Schumer, she's having a great year, like I said, was nominated for Best Variety Sketch Series, as was Key and Peele.
That's right. Let's just jump to Key and Peele right away, shall we?
Okay.
They're saying goodbye.
Yeah, that's right. As a matter of fact, that was when I heard that, I went, wow, what? That's a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a big deal. They're walking away from their show when it's as big as ever. It's their fifth season. It's airing right now. And they said, you know what? Our current season is our last. I think basically, you know, they've had a great run. They've got a ton of opportunities for movies and other things. They've got an animated spinoff of the show. And I think they just felt like, well, why wear out our welcome? You know, a sketch show is really all consuming. It's really hard to do and come up with great material. They've done it for 5 years. They've had a lot of success in social media and with clips. And now they're just going to move on to other things rather than just keep driving the show into the ground. You know, it's really hard to do well. And I feel like they just think, hey, why not walk away when we're on top? That's very hard to do. It's very rare to walk away when you have a big hit show. This show is bigger than it's ever been. Finally getting some Emmy recognition. It's only been 5 seasons.
And, I thought it was 4, but okay.
I believe this is their 5th and final season. But
okay.
We can check up on that. So, you know. That is very, very rare. You know, Dave Chappelle did the same thing, but in sort of a more collapsing, oh my God, I don't know what's happening sort of way. Yeah, this is their 5th season. So these guys are doing it when they're still in control, you know.
Yeah.
They're not having a breakdown. They're just saying, hey, all right, we're done. You know, let's go on to movies. Let's go on to other things. You know, we've got a lot more to explore, and we don't want to beat this into the ground. So, you know, that's pretty admirable. You know, maybe Amy Schumer will do that in a year or two. We'll have to see.
Oh, I'll tell you, if Amy Schumer did that in a year or two, I would actually put the head of Comedy Central on suicide watch.
Oh my God, yes. They've lost Jon Stewart, they've lost Stephen Colbert, they've lost John Oliver, now they've lost Key and Peele. I mean, they really, yeah, it's been a bad year for Comedy Central.
Yeah, definitely a big deal for them.
Yes.
Which brings us, by the way, to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about Oscar winner Laura Poitras. In fact, she's Academy Award-winning documentary filmmaker Laura Poitras. That's on her business card, in fact. She has filed a Freedom of Information Act about her detentions at the border and airports when entering and leaving the country for a 6-year period. Poitras won an Oscar for Citizen 4, a movie about NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, but the government of both George W. Bush and Barack Obama harassed her repeatedly using its powers at the borders to seize her equipment, detain her for hours at a time, threaten arrest, wrongly claim she was a criminal, and so on, all without ever obtaining a warrant. It forced Poitras to do her work overseas. She kind of moved to Germany, I think. Now she wants information about the government's abuse of its border controls to harass law-abiding citizens who were exercising their rights of the freedom of the press. Is that righteous enough for you? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. No matter what you think about Edward Snowden or her film, the Hollywood community really should rally around her to say, hey, look, you know, you can't harass people at the borders just because you don't like the work that they're doing. You know, she never broke any laws. You know, she never did anything wrong. She's never even been accused of anything or even charged with anything. And clearly she was harassed and tried to, you know, muffle her rights of freedom of speech and freedom of the press. And, you know, it's wrong. And so I hope that the MPAA and the Academy and other Hollywood groups would rally to her defense and not worry about whether they agree or disagree with what Edward Snowden did. This is not what we're talking about. We're talking about the rights of filmmakers to go about their business without the government harassing them.
In comedy, timing is everything.
Well done.
Yes. Apparently, the same is true in writing a celebrity biography. Mark Whitaker published a generally positive but not fawning biography of comedian Bill Cosby, focusing mostly on his public career, but politely including examples of infidelity over the years. It was well-reviewed and came complete with celebrity quotes praising the cause. Then long simmering allegations Cosby was a serial rapist gained traction, and suddenly Whitaker's book looked hapless and out of date, if not downright enabling. Whitaker apologized and promised to include updates in a paperback edition. Then celebrities got embarrassed that their comments praising Cosby could still be found on the book's cover and asked for those comments to be removed. The publisher, Simon & Schuster, decided, hey, you know what, enough is enough. They pulled all the celebrity blurbs. There won't be any paperback edition. Whitaker won't include new material. And when it goes out of print, it will stay out of print. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because it's a good example of how not to handle a crisis.
Yes, I would agree.
I mean, for God's sakes, you know, he'd covered all that territory. He'd had access to a lot of people. There was nothing stopping him from doing a solid, respectable update that made up for the, you know, many, many faults of the book as far as covering that stuff. You know, they should have done that and gotten that in the ebook and sent it out to people right away. You know, nowadays, you don't have to wait for a new print edition to update your book. So they could have been very proactive. This guy should have been on every news media talking about, my God, a deer just ran across my lawn. I am clearly upstate. A deer just ran across the lawn. But anyway, Mark Whitaker was poised to be a great resource on as long as he wasn't carrying water for Cosby and didn't look pathetic. He could say, hey, look, I'm just like everybody else. I didn't want to believe it. I didn't want to hear about it. And I was wrong. You know, and it could have brought attention to the book. They could have updated the book because it's a solid biography of Cosby. I mean, that's only one aspect of his life, as horrible as it is. He did a lot of great comedy and significant things in TV and comedy albums and elsewhere. And it's a career worth discussing. And, you know, he's an expert on Cosby. And they blew it 8 ways to Sunday. I don't get it.
You could almost say they were a deer caught in headlights.
That's right. Yeah. Yet more fallout. Spelman College, which Cosby's had a long relationship with, he and his wife had endowed a chair or professorship at Spelman, and now they've just reneged on that. They put it on hold for a while, and now they said, never mind, we're not doing this again, and they sent back the money, the unused funds. So it's just an ugly, ugly, ugly period for, you know, who was one of the great comics and now has destroyed his legacy by decades of being a horrible, evil person.
Yeah, although I would, you know, again, I wouldn't mind there being some, because these are all, until somebody actually takes him to court or he gets criminally charged, which I wouldn't mind seeing, you know, it's all alleged. And he hasn't, now, mind you, I'm not saying that these stories aren't true. What I'm saying is I could say he raped me, and there, you know,
he was a horrible, terrible person. I didn't say he was a convicted rapist. Fact is that Spelman College and any media company that wants to distance themselves from Cosby because of things that they believe or hear about him or, you know, have good reason to believe are true, that's a different standard than putting them in jail. I'm not saying he should be in jail. See, people are suing him. If they succeed, they will win damages. You know, convicting him for a alleged rape 20, 30, 40 years ago, it's not going to happen. You know, it's not possible, really, in most cases. So, you know, this is the worst that can happen to him. But yeah, he's becoming shunned publicly, but it seems like it's well-deserved.
Speaking of well-deserved, Willie Nelson can add another feather to his cap. The country legend has been selected by the Library of Congress to receive the Gershwin Prize, following the likes of Paul McCartney, Stevie Wonder, Paul Simon, and Carole King. Nelson is the first country artist to receive the award. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. The Gershwin Prize is gaining legitimacy as it goes on. I mean, it's also been given to, I think we covered everybody. Hal David and Burt Bacharach, they got it. Billy Joel has gotten it. It's named after George and Ira Gershwin, of course. Willie Nelson certainly belongs in that company. Country music certainly belongs in that company. I imagine it would have gone first to Hank Williams, except he's dead. And I guess you got to be alive to get it.
Yes.
But, you know, they have mostly men. And I know they discounted Carole King. Was she last year? I'm not sure. Maybe they didn't want to do two women in a row, but I wish it had been Dolly Parton, because she is a great songwriter, probably even better songwriter than Willie Nelson. And she's got such a huge body of work. She would have been a great first addition from country music. Willie Nelson certainly deserves to be there. Absolutely. He belongs in any Hall of Fame that he's remotely eligible for because he's one of the legends. But Dolly Parton would have stopped that imbalance, been a great representative for country music, and deserved to be up there too.
Well, you know, the Library of Congress was going to award the Gershwin Prize to Dolly Parton, but when it came to awarding somebody in country music, they said Willie Nelson was always on their mind.
You know, I said, oh God, what is he going to do? What's he going to say? I knew he was coming up with some joke. That was pretty good. Not bad. Speaking of music, Wilco gave away their new album.
What?
Right?
They gave it away. To who? Huh? Which band is going to take credit for it now?
That's right. They gave away their new album. They said you can download it for free via iTunes or their website. All they asked for in exchange, I don't know if you had to do this for iTunes, but if you did it via their website, you gave them an email so they could then send you a link and say, okay, you're approved. They say they're not going to use it for promotional purposes. But what they did do was a week later, they sent you a new email and said, hey, thanks for downloading the album. Hope you love it. The only reason we could afford to do this was because we've had a long career and lots of album sales and lots of support over the years. But most other new bands can't do that. So don't think music should be free just because we gave you our album for free. You know, we're in the place where we can do that. But hey, please support these other new acts. And they listed new albums and new artists by a bunch of new acts like William Tyler and smaller, less well-known acts, 11th Dream Day and so on and so forth. And said, hey, they've got new albums out. Please buy their album. Support these artists. We love them. You should love them too. So I thought that was very cool. They used their free giveaway as a chance to lift up other artists who don't have the legacy that Wilco does.
That's the way to do it. And I guess the way people are doing it these days, at least musicians, is they record an album and then release it spontaneously.
That's right.
And if you read the book, How Music Got Free, you'll see why people are doing that.
Because they can?
Because they can, but also it prevents leaks. And
no piracy, right, yeah.
Yeah.
But in this case, they weren't even trying to sell it. They could have released it spontaneously and charged for it.
That's true. Beyonce did. The NFL is facing a $12 billion antitrust lawsuit over an exclusive deal with DirecTV. Fans are suing, claiming they have to pay too much to get access to games featuring the team they want to see. The NFL says, yeah, tough. The courts? They haven't said anything yet. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a very big deal because sports is, there's such money in sports. It's the last vestige of programming that can draw a big audience on network television and cable and online. You know, everybody wants to see sports and they want to see it live. There are all these complicated deals. I assumed every franchise was at the stage where fans could buy access to their own team. But yeah, you know, if it's in that market, you can't. If it's in another market, you know, they're charging too much money. You have to pay $200-$300 just to get access to your one team if you're in an it's just a mess. And it does, you know, look like it could have a viable antitrust lawsuit. It just seems like it could gain some traction. The $12 billion, of course, is just a number thrown out by lawyers. But if they force the NFL to do their business differently and make their games available in more ways than one so that fans don't have to pay a massive amount to DirecTV just to get their one team's, you know, 10 regular season games, it'll probably be for the best.
You can't quit. You're fired. That's the story at ESPN, where the exodus of top talent continues. Keith Olbermann slipped away after realizing they had nowhere to put him. Bill Simmons left to join HBO. Well, he left really because they didn't renew his contract, but...
No. They wanted him. They tried to keep him. They aggressively went after him.
Okay, well, he left for HBO, and he's going to bring his hugely popular podcast and social media talents to bear there, and he's going to, you know, reap the rewards for it.
That's right, because that was one... My understanding is that was one of the big bugaboos. He has this huge, wildly successful podcast, and he wants to control it and own it and have the piece of it. And they were like, didn't want to let him do that.
Yeah.
They weren't willing to let him reap the benefits of all the social media stuff that he was creating. So I think they really missed the boat on that, you know, social media and podcasts and websites and things like that, that people do that generate money, you know, they're going to want control of that and take it with them wherever they go. And media companies are going to have to learn that's the new normal.
Well, maybe HBO will get into websites so Simmons can duplicate the magic of Grantland, which he also brought to ESPN. Now, the latest significant name to bolt ESPN is Colin Cowherd. He's a big name in ESPN radio, and Cowherd is headed to Fox Sports, where he'll continue in radio, get a daily TV show, and appear in their football lineup on Sundays. He'll be playing quarterback. Cowherd, Cowherd was negotiating to get out of his contract early. Then Cowherd made an awkward comment about, you know, Dominican baseball players on the radio, and ESPN said, you know what, actually, why don't you leave right now? Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal overall. The Colin Cowherd comment was unfortunate. When you look at it in context, he said Dominican ballplayers weren't educated. You don't have to be smart to play baseball because look at Dominicans. But when you actually looked at the full comments that he made, he was talking for a little while about the education system in the Dominican Republic and how it's not up to snuff and how it should be better. And so he was as much saying they don't have access to good education. But it doesn't work on any level, any way you slice it, because you can be very smart and play baseball. Most sports people are dumb, but you can be very smart and play baseball. It is a complex game, just as anything is complex. And so, and it doesn't work to say that Dominicans are dumb. So he loses no matter way, but it was not the hateful comment necessarily that it was pulled out of context to be. Nonetheless, that was bad. It was dumb. He's apologized, but he's a real talent, and it's yet another person leaving ESPN. And maybe it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter, does it, Sperling? Because what people tune into ESPN for, perhaps, is the sports. But no, it's a 24-hour channel. And they have people that they have to host shows and bring people in, even when there's no sports on, don't they?
Yeah, so, I mean, I only tune in to find a score, or, you know, if I'm at the gym and it's, I can't.
But you're not a big sports guy.
I'm a big sports guy, you know.
You are?
Somewhat.
Who do you season tickets to any sporting team?
My daughter's soccer game.
What was the last sporting event you went to and paid tickets for?
The Boston Red Sox versus the Kansas City Royals last year.
What were they doing in LA?
I was in Boston.
Oh, okay. Well, they're fair enough. What about last time in Los Angeles?
We don't have a football team, so I can't.
You watch a lot on TV?
I do, actually.
Okay, cool.
Baseball, football, the other balls, all the balls.
Okay. All the balls.
Yes. Wrestling, in fact. In fact, you know, speaking of saying stuff you shouldn't, legendary wrestler Hulk Hogan has been summarily dumped by the WWE. He was suing over the release of a sex tape that leaked to the world.
Via Gawker, by the way.
Via Gawker, yes. Unfortunately, court records included transcripts of all the video, not just the sexy bits. Those transcripts of private conversations made some 8 years ago had Hogan using a racial slur about the young black man his daughter was dating, saying he wished she was dating a famous basketball player instead of this guy if she was going to date a... Insert racial slur here. Hogan immediately apologized and said it was wrong and doesn't reflect who he is, but the WWE, the worldwide... What is it?
World Wrestling Entertainment.
World Wrestling... They cut all ties to him. Anyway, big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop, of course, in the scheme of things. I don't want to spend my week defending people who make racially insensitive comments or just utterly indefensible racial slurs like Hogan did. But, you know, it was in private. You know, it was not something he said in public or media. He has no public record of racism that, as far as I know, or making racially charged comments. You know, he's never done anything publicly that paints him in a negative way. This isn't like part of a pattern or trend. So while I wish all people would not use racial slurs in private, you know, of course, what matters really is what they say and do in public and how they treat other people. And as far as I know, Hulk Hogan, you know, this is not like, oh, the final straw that broke the camel's back. It's like, should the guy be using that slur to talk about another human being? Of course not. Should he pay a price for it? Yeah. But like to immediately like just throw him out and fire him and cut him off from your business because of something he said in private 8 years ago that is not reflective of what he said and what he's done in public before and since then, I feel like it is PC overreaction.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Give a guy a chance to apologize and explain himself and admit it was indefensible and try to make good for it and, you know, make something positive out of it. But, you know, it just makes no sense to me. It's just ridiculous.
Well, Paula Deen was saying stuff in private. And she still, you know, got lambasted.
That was hiring practices.
Oh, true, but, true. You're right.
That's employment hiring. If Hulk Hogan... And I doubt he has a lot of black people working for him. What do I know? I don't know. His daughter was playing a black guy. Apparently he raised her right.
Well, speaking of racism here, so Atticus Finch, he's a racist apparently, and Harper Lee is still a big name in publishing. And he fears that the awkward way the prequel came to light might, and the prequel to Kill a Mockingbird, that is, might discourage readers where, you know, all of that was put to rest, really. Lee's novel, Ghost Set of Watchmen, sold 1.1 million copies right off the bat. I think it's only been out for like a week or two, right, Michael?
Yep.
Well, it became the fastest-selling adult title in HarperCollins history. Many chains said it was their biggest one-day seller since the final Harry Potter book. The publisher expects it to be their biggest-selling title of the year. Harper Lee says, I wrote another book? Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. You know, it was a big gamble in a way. It was shadowed by controversy, and now it's proving a commercial hit, so it's good for the publisher. What was interesting here was the breakdown in where they sold copies. They sold 700,000 plus copies in print, which means, I guess, they sold about 400,000 copies in ebook. And that's actually a very high percentage for print, though perhaps not unusual for literary fiction. But what they looked at was they said the last time a book sold this much in print was, I think, a Dan Brown book. And it sold over 1 million copies in print. And that was in the era before ebooks had really taken hold. So what they're saying here is, like, this is the biggest seller in print in the ebook era. So it's sort of like, wow, we can still sell 700,000 copies of a book in print, even now that ebook has really, you know, consumed a lot of bandwidth. So even in publishing, where people talk about, you know, ebook is dead and didn't work and it's slowing down and print is king, you know, no, publishing world really took note that this book moved a lot of copies in print. You know, it's probably an older audience, right? You know, probably, you know, people who had copies of To Kill a Mockingbird and thought they wanted a physical copy of this book. They didn't just want to read it. They wanted to own it and put it on their shelf because the original was so beloved. So they can still sell print copies, and Harper Lee's Ghost of the Watchman is proof.
Well, and, you know, you're probably right, because the last time this author wrote a book was 50 years ago. So, yeah, the people who liked their first book, you know, of course, it's been a beloved book, and, you know, everybody knows this book. It was made into a very popular classic movie starring Gregory Peck. Have you read the book?
Nope.
Do you plan on reading the book?
Probably not. I mean, it's not even the original is not one that is beloved of mine. I'm not quite sure why it has such a status that it did. It's good, but not great. I didn't really love it. Don't like the film very much either.
Okay. Well, I mean, do you think, you know, the big controversy here was, did she really write this book? Or did she write it and put it away because she didn't think it was very good?
We know she wrote it. It was her first draft, and her editor said, this isn't great. Here's the section that really works. You need to rework this book and make it set in this era when her as a child, because that's where the strength in your writing works. And they went back and spent several years working, laboring over drafts, and created a book considered by many a masterpiece, To Kill a Mockingbird. That's what this book is. It's not a different book. It's the first draft of what became To Kill a Mockingbird. And it's set in a different era and tells a different story. But basically, you know, the editor said, hey, this isn't good, but this stuff is really strong. Let's work on this. And that became To Kill a Mockingbird. Is it of interest to scholars and people? Yeah. Is it worthy of public interest? Probably not. And do I believe that Harper Lee gave full assent? I mean, you know, frankly, despite the state people coming in and catching her at a good time of day when she seemed lucid, I don't buy it at all. You know, her sister's dead. She's had a stroke and is you know, wavering in her mental capacities. And now suddenly is when she decides to print a new book. I don't think so.
Yeah. After 50 years. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So we're on the same page on that one. No pun intended.
Finally. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, the one thing I'm confused by is people say, oh, no, Atticus Finch is racist. But it seems to me to be the difference from not having read the book. You know, To Kill a Mockingbird is a little girl looking up at her dad as an admiring hero. The new book, Ghost of the Watchman, is that same girl coming back as an adult after having lived in New York City, coming back to her hometown and seeing her father and the town in a new light. I don't think those are contradictory. That the man who behaved nobly in the first book is the same man, perhaps, as the man who makes some racial, you know, tinged comments and belongs to the KKK and thinks black people need a lot of years before they can catch up to white people. You know, he's not the most hateful of races. He's like the faux Southern. Well, you know, they're just children now. We need to help, you know, that sort of thing. I don't see there's a big contradiction between the two. And thinking that there is part of the problem of race today in America.
Neil Young says music quality sucks. Young hated CDs and the bright metallic sound they encouraged. He always insisted LPs were better. So after decades of seeing record labels go from the LP to 8-track to cassette to CD to the compressed MP3 format and now streaming, Young has had enough. Streaming sound quality is even worse than MP3, he says. And he'd rather fans didn't listen to his music at all, at least not in a way that sets audio quality back some 60 years. He's yanked his music from all streaming services and encourages others to do the same. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, unfortunately, because other people are not going to follow suit.
Also, I call a little bit of BS on this because he still has his albums for sale on iTunes, you know, the biggest music retailer in the world.
But streaming is even lower. He's not yanking from MP3. He's yanking from streaming. Streaming is even crappier quality than compressed MP3.
Okay.
That's what he's claiming.
And yet his Pono Music Service, his albums are still streaming there, which he claims
sound
better. Well,
Pono has a much higher sound quality.
That's what he claims, yes.
He doesn't claim it. It's true.
Well,
claiming it, it's true. It is a much higher sound quality. You know, you can have albums available in FLAC, you know, which is a much better sound quality than compressed MP3. It's not a claim. It's true. You know, streaming sound quality is not great. Whether you need that extra sound when you're listening on headphones as you walk with your iPhone down the street, I don't know. A lot of audio people will say, well, no, not really. But, you know, is sound quality great on streaming and even MP3? No, I don't think it is. I think you can notice the sound does sound better. But I'll tell you, I tried to get some sales figures for Pono. Sales figures for the Pono device, for Pono albums.
Good luck with
for
that.
Pono anything? Nothing, not a word.
Yeah.
So clearly not working well.
Here, I have a figure for you. How about some figures about Netflix? Because they have now hit 65 million streaming subscribers worldwide. So maybe they can get some good movies finally. They're also planning to speed up the release of Spike Lee's new film for an Oscar qualifying run because they're so high on the quality of his drama, Chirac. Okay, so it's like Chicago, I guess it
and
looks
Iraq.
At, yep.
Yeah, Chicago and Iraq, exactly.
Yeah, it looks at the growing violence in Chicago and stars Samuel L. Jackson and John Cusack. Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal.
What? Wait,
well,
that's a big
I'm
deal?
Excited for John Cusack. I want him to have a good film again.
Oh, okay.
So I'm hoping the movie is good. You also mentioned how they don't have any good movies, right?
Well,
they got a lot of TV shows, they got a lot of movies, but they don't have a good library, really.
No,
if
they
you
don't.
Want to look for classic, I never use Netflix because I'm blessed to have, you know, a gazillion DVDs and Blu-rays. And I interviewed a Tony winner, Mary Louise Wilson, for her new memoir, which is great. And she said, oh, yeah, you know, I like Netflix, but kids these days, they don't know about, you know, classic movies because they're not there. Like, you want to watch Hitchcock, they've got maybe The Birds or Psycho, and that's it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, what about the DVDs? And she's like, what? They have DVDs? I go, yeah, it's a different service. You got to pay more, but I'm sure in their DVD library, they've got all the classic Hollywood movies. And of course, they do. And Netflix did just announce that they have 5.3 million DVD subscribers. Now,
wow.
That's down from 20 million just a few years ago, back in 2010. So obviously, it's a fading part of their business, but they are maintaining it. And there's a New York Times article we linked to about how they, you know, keep working to, because they know there's people who want DVDs and also want access to both really recent films, which are not available on streaming yet because it takes a while to get there, and really old films.
Yes.
Like all the Hitchcocks. Those are all available on DVD and Blu-ray via Netflix. All the classic movies that you won't find on Netflix. So instead of wasting your time watching Pixels when it comes out on streaming a year from now, why not watch a classic movie? You know, so Netflix DVD and Blu-ray system, something to think about.
Although I will say that if you watched Pixels via streaming, it may not be bad.
Well, it couldn't get worse.
Yeah, it's appropriate.
Okay.
You know.
Oh, fair enough.
Ironically. Now, China continues to expand into animation, not always politely. A new animated film called The Autobots received criticism from fans and critics alike for ripping off ideas from Pixar's Cars movies. The poster for the film is almost identical, and the lead car character is a dead ringer for Lightning McQueen. Ka-chow! The movie has proven a flop, but that didn't stop the director from using social media to attack anyone who didn't support his film as, quote, Chinese traitors, and, quote, again, brain damaged. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? Ciao.
Well, it's you've got kids watching Cars, don't you?
Yes, I do.
So, yeah, I guess now the next Chinese film will be Burbie the Love Bug. Yeah, no, it's a big deal because it's another indication of China really pushing into animation. We've been talking about that for a few weeks now, that they're really making a big push because they think that's where they can make their mark. They're making all sorts of movies. They're pouring lots of money into animation. This movie clearly is not up to snuff creatively. It doesn't sound like it's that well animated either. But I think it's just a clue of a Wild West new era where they're just trying to make a lot of animated films and grabbing ideas left and right. So I think it's a sign of the past for just ripping off a big Hollywood movie. Countries have done that all over the world. They do their local version and rip it off and use the similar poster, similar ideas. And I think that's the past. But animation for China is definitely the future.
Angry face, frowny face. And of course, I'm talking about this emoji film project that is going to be, I guess this is a lot. It can't be a live action. It's got to be animated, right?
I don't know. It does. Yeah. It's Sony Animation.
And I guess Sony won a bidding war and they're going to make a film about emojis. Those little round faces that have, you know, kids talking these days.
Oh, we're not talking as the case may be.
Exactly.
Certainly texting. Not typing.
Yeah.
So like the smiley face, the hearts, all that stuff, emojis will be in a movie.
Yes.
Fascinating. Only in Hollywood would that be an exciting idea.
And then AT&T.
And it hasn't been written. It's just an idea. It will be co-written by Eric Siegel and Anthony Leondis. So we're talking, we had a great idea for emojis. What if we had, you know?
Yeah.
Dear God, write a script first.
Cucumber. That's a joke because, you know, there's some weird, I don't know.
Keep going.
All right. Okay. Well, that brings us to AT&T. Of course, last week, there was some news from AT&T and DirecTV. It was easy, in fact, very easy. AT&T received FCC approval for its merge with DirecTV. $49 billion takeover is what we're talking about here, which in our brave new world counts as, you know, kind of, you know, chump change, modest. The telecom giant wasted no time finalizing the merger as soon as it received approval, and now the two companies are one. The one caveat, by the way, is that AT&T is urged to speed up its deployment of high-speed broadband to 12.5 million customer locations within 4 years, an initiative that has slowed, if not entirely stopped, recently. Consumer groups opposed to the merger said AT&T didn't need to buy out a competitor in order to expand broadband, and in fact, having a competitor would have made upgrading its network more likely. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop. We knew it would happen, right?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of felt like, you know, you have some of these smaller players. I don't want to call them smaller players, but it's not Comcast. You know, it's not two of the biggest companies in the nation getting 30 to 35% market share. It's smaller companies trying to become a bigger company.
Yes, a $49 billion takeover of smaller companies. Just two little kids with a dream, DirecTV and AT&T.
Nobody's saying they didn't overpay for it. Okay.
And the idea that like, well, okay, you can merge, but you really got to work on that broadband. You know, really? That's their big caveat. AT&T's really put the brakes on broadband, haven't they?
Yes. Well, yes and no. I mean, they basically are expanding in the markets where they already have a presence, and in markets where they don't have a presence, they could care less. They're not doing anything. Yep. But they basically have said we'll bring it to 12.5 more locations within the next 4 years. The point of, well, you know, they didn't need to buy a competitor to do that. Yes and no, I get it. They could have used that money to expand their network, but if they weren't guaranteed the customers, they might not necessarily expand, you know, use that money.
They're not guaranteed customers.
Well, true, but with one less competitor, there's a better chance.
AT&T wasn't doing broadband. This letting them merge with DirecTV has nothing to do with that. So that caveat to the deal, that stick for the carrot, I guess, is just kind of pointless. It's got nothing. If they needed to be pushed to do broadband, they should have been, but it's got nothing to do with this merger, you know.
No, this is all about TV. That's what this is about. And it's about getting...
Streaming video, you mean?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
That's what this is about. But ultimately, that concludes, I guess, DirecTV as a standalone company and this week's, or these 2 weeks segment of Big Deal or Big Whoop, and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And for certainly for our European listeners, this really could affect every single one of you because
bonjour.
That's German, right?
No.
Oh. Spanish? No.
Hola.
So needless to say, European Union, they are on this antitrust kick, and they decided, you know, we will take on the six major Hollywood studios. We will sue all of them.
Yeah, and what they're suing them for is the idea that they had a lot of people in the EU who pay for a service, like watching their TV shows or their movies, and when they go from England to France, they can't watch it anymore.
That's right.
They get frustrated and annoyed. Or you're BBC and you got a BBC iPlayer, and if you go to Germany and try to watch your BBC iPlayer to watch your TV shows that you've paid for, they're saying, hey, you're in a different country. It's like long distance service used to be for, you know, Northern. They say, oh, you're going to pay a lot of money for that. And they're saying, well, that's wrong. We're sick of, what is it called? Geo-blocking.
Yeah. Basically what they're doing, and this is true, by the way, in the analog world. If you were a film studio, you would go out and you'd sell the rights to your film in France or in all French-speaking territories or in Spain or in Germany. And you would be able to collect fees in each one of those territories separately, as opposed to what the EU wants, which is, or at least they're claiming they want, which is they want, once you sell it to, you know, the UK and you cut a deal with Sky UK, which is the TV pay TV broadcaster in question here, they want that available throughout the EU, throughout all of the countries in the EU, so that,
for example, they want it to be treated as the EU.
That's correct.
You don't sell a movie right to Texas, you sell it for the US.
Correct.
And they want the same idea to take place in Europe. They want to say, hey, look, we're one big market. Sure, we've got a dozen different languages, but we're one big market and you need to treat us as one. So if you want to sell rights to Europe, it's got to be Europe. You can't do it by England, France, Germany, Spain, and whatever anymore. It's got to be all one big pile.
Yeah, this, by the way, this ruling would, you know, talking
upend about, everything.
Yes, I can't even stress how important this ruling could be if it actually goes through and they decide that yes, you have to sell to the entire EU, not just you know, the Netherlands, not just Copenhagen.
And the courts must understand. The EU must understand how transformative this ruling would be
for
all these. I mean, it's wildly impactful.
I mean, it would literally transform the way films are made, because the way they get financed today,
and TV shows,
the way all of these get financed is you go out and sometimes you have output deals per territory. So you have an output deal in Germany, you have an output deal in you know, Turkey, and in different territories. What they're saying is, and I know Turkey's not a part of the EU, but you know, here they want just one output deal for all of the EU, which would kind of either increase that deal, the amount of that one deal significantly, or it would lower it so much that the movie couldn't be made in the first place.
So you'd have a lot of countries that have local film industries like France and Spain and Germany, where those players now need to be EU-wide, and suddenly there'd be maybe less French-specific films made.
That's right.
I mean, that is a possible impact, that yes, you would have one big market, and you'd have movies being shown and broadcast and, you know, rights paid for and all over in the physical. But are they sort of missing the boat here? I've always thought that the world was moving to a language-based marketing rights, meaning if you buy the rights to a book, you buy the rights to that book in English, as opposed to the United States and England and Australia and people in India and elsewhere who want to read the book in English. So you're buying the rights for the language rather than the territory.
Well, you just
they're
said
sort
that
of stuck in the territory mindset, which doesn't make as much sense when you're talking about movies that are filmed in English and can't be watched in French and German and Spanish.
Well, they still can be watched
until you dub them or translate them or do whatever to them.
Right. Well, you know, you said that the courts have to understand how transformative this would be to the business. And I would say you're right. They should understand that, but they may not. Given the fact
they would have to, they've been investigating for 18 months. My God, they must know that every contract would be upended. Every deal made would have to be rethought, rethunk, re-engineered, rejiggered, you know, or like maybe it's all the deals going forward or whatever, but it would be a hugely, and the benefits could be good and bad. All right. There's sure to be a mix, but do you think it would be mostly good or mostly bad, or what do you think would happen?
It's hard to say, but certainly at least in that territory, because it is like going from Texas to Oklahoma, it's you know, it can be a little frustrating. But
so it'd be great for consumers.
It'd be good for consumers, not necessarily great for the industry.
Well, do you think have a negative cultural impact? Maybe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it probably will.
Mm-hmm. More homogenized Euro-wide entertainment.
Yes. Yes. Correct. And you'd, or at least for now, it would be primarily in English, and I think you probably have a big French industry push as well.
And the business models for everybody would have to go back to the drawing board.
Yes, literally you would have to throw out every spreadsheet you have and figure something else out.
Wow.
Even if it didn't pertain to television or movies, still throw out all your spreadsheets.
So they filed antitrust regulations. Do you know where they did? Is it to the EU itself, or where have they filed these formal charges? Who's going to make a decision?
I don't know. Actually, I think it goes through the court system. I can't believe you didn't like my spreadsheet joke.
It was a good joke.
I think, yeah, it's going to go through the court system the same way it would here.
EU courts.
Yes, correct.
All right. Wow.
And at the end, Greece may not be a country in the...
That's right. You'll still have to do a new deal for Greece.
Yes, exactly. But that's what's going on. At least that's what's, you know, the insiders in the industry are talking about.
Hey, and if someone is impacted by that in the EU, how can they contact us to let us know how or what they think of that?
Well, they could write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. They could call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7255. 7263. They could even, if they really wanted to, reach out on Twitter. Our handle is at Showbiz Sandbox, or you could like us on Facebook where our page is Showbiz Sandbox.
That's true. Now, Theodore Bakel probably won't contact us this week. I don't think he ever even listened to the show, and now he's dead.
And it's because he didn't listen to the show that
he's dead?
Yeah. Is that a stretch? Wow. Is that a stretch?
That might be a stretch.
Okay, well.
So who is Theodore Bakel?
He played 2,200 performances as Tevye. And if you don't know who Tevye is, that is one of the characters in Fiddler on the Roof.
That's the man. And Fiddler on the Roof is being revived December 17th. So, you know, he probably would have been at the opening. He was 91 years old. He did not originate the role of Tevye. That was originated by Zero Mostel, who won the Tony Award. But he took it over and he played it then on and in revivals. And for decades to come, he became thoroughly, you know, combined with that role. He also created, in this case,
combined
Captain Von
Trapp. Or identified? I think identified.
Identified, yeah. Sure. He also created the role of Captain Von Trapp in the original production of The Sound of Music. So, you know, he had Academy Award nomination for playing a sheriff in The Defiant Ones. He co-founded the Newport Folk Festival. That I did not know, but he was a big folk singer, recorded a lot of albums. He founded the folk festival with Pete Seeger and others, and he was the first person to cover Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind in public. He was the first guy to sing that song in public other than Bob Dylan. So kind of a fascinating career. Everybody had a lot of fun with all the roles he played of various ethnicities, because Theodore Bakel spoke a number of languages, and he played every type of character, you know, Viennese, Dutch, German, French, Russian, you name it. You know, he always played, you wanted some ethnic guy, get Theodore Bakel. So a long, rich, fascinating career.
You know who also had a long, rich, fascinating career? It was one of my favorite authors, E.L. Doctorow.
He wrote. Is he really? Yeah, is he really one of your favorite authors?
Well, I liked his books. Let's put it that way.
Well, no, I'm not questioning it. I was a little surprised at how much of a major literary figure he was treated as. It hadn't really registered with me. I think it's because a lot of his books were turned into movies that weren't very good.
That's right, yeah.
Ragtime, The Book of Daniel, Billy Bathgate. Ragtime was probably the best of those three. Interesting movie. But Book of Daniel became a movie with Timothy Hutton called Daniel. Billy Bathgate, a bad movie. I never even saw it. He had bad luck when it came to translations and adaptations, and I never really read him very much until I finally, just a few years ago, read Ragtime, which I absolutely loved and thought was a masterpiece.
Yes,
I mean,
it
gave him 4 stars. I haven't read anything else yet by him, but now I'm really eager because the New York Times and everyone else treated him like a major, major literary star.
Yes, Updikean, if you will.
Well, yeah.
Cheever-esque.
Yeah, well, yes. And Funchin, you should mention John Updike, because he famously didn't like E.L. Doctorow, hated how he played with history and changed facts just to, you know, do his stories, and thought it was cheating and really did not like him. But he reviewed The March, which was a book about Sherman's march to the sea that had a chorus of characters in it, real and imaginary. And he gave a rave review for that book, declared it his masterpiece, and said it won him over to E.L. Doctorow. And when you look at the other obits for Doctorow, a lot of them mentioned The March as his masterpiece. So I'm certainly looking forward to reading that. But you know, a very innovative, interesting, experimental author, and I really didn't appreciate that until I read these obituaries.
You know what he's saying now? Great. I'm dead. Now you like me.
That's right, but there's no better way to celebrate his career than to dive into one of his books. If you haven't read Ragtime, that's certainly a good place to start.
Yeah, Ragtime is very good. We do have some listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Now, we're going to shorten it a little bit because it was a lengthy email from C.J. Flynn of D Cinema Tools. He writes, "Hi, guys. One point to add to your India/China conversation."
What was that India-China conversation?
I think that was 2 episodes ago. We were talking about the difference of ticket prices in China and India. And
the size of their box office and everything.
That's right.
That's right. They both have billion-plus people. China is growing massively. India is much smaller.
That's right.
But what did CJ say?
Well, he says, sure, they can't repatriate as much of the income that they make from the movies in China, but they can use the money in other ways. For example, Universal and Disney and others are spending a fortune on theme parks and movie lots in China, so they can spend that money there.
And all right.
In terms of the shortened window for 2 horror films, wow, talk about exhibition just being the trailer ad for other release mediums. And he's referring there to, I guess, the Paranormal Activity and the zombie thing that, you know, Paramount is going to release 17 days after there's a whole algorithm as to when they're going to release the film early on. But
earlier than usual, and the theaters get a cut of the pie.
Right. In the UK, the BBC is fighting government attempts to slash its budget by $1 billion. We mentioned that. The latest cost overruns of the UK's two unneeded aircraft carriers has increased by $3 billion each, and more when the planes are added. Not that politics and culture need to intersect. Speaking of politics and culture, the other podcast that I listen to is Harry Shearer's Le Show, which for years, and I believe still is, a radio show on KCRW, and now he's moved it someplace else. Harry Shearer mentioned, I'm only mentioning this because I guess he's gotten, he's taken back up by Fox for the Simpsons again. We kind of mentioned that last week, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Thanks for the show, CJ. So thank you.
And that's it for this week, isn't it?
Yes, that is it for this week. A letter from CJ or an email from CJ, and we're off to I'm off.
Well, you're off to Hawaii.
Yes, looking for the prequel of Lilo and Stitch. I'm gonna look for Stitch or Lilo. I can't remember which one was the alien and which one was the little girl. Lilo is the little girl, right?
Lilo and Stitch. Yeah, Lilo is the little girl, I believe. Yeah. So if you're going to Hawaii, I recommend you read perhaps James Michener's Hawaii, which is a joke from my friend's short film, or read W.S. Merwin's The Folding Cliffs, which is an epic poem about white people and Hawaiians and leprosy. And it's a fascinating, it's like a narrative poem. It's very easy to read. It's like a story. It's not like, you know, you won't feel yourself weighted down by a poem, you know, so it's really, really terrific piece. And I recommend it highly.
Actually, Michael, thank you very much. You just reminded me that I have to read When We Are Called to Part by Brooke Jarvis. I believe that's the story. There was a story about a leper colony in Hawaii on Lanai, and which is a true, you know, it's a true place. So you reminded me that I have to read that.
Yeah, well, good idea.
It's on the Atavist for anybody that's interested. And boy, I've got a lot of reading to do, actually. Now.
Yes, you do. And then we'll be back in 2 weeks, won't we?
Yes, we will. But in the meantime, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher. Any place they give podcasts away for free, or you can download podcasts, that's where you can find us. And please do rate and review the show in those aggregators. It does help us out. So does subscribing to the show. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That is also where you will find ways to follow us on Twitter, at showbizsandbox, like us on Facebook, search for Showbiz Sandbox, all those ways to contact us that we've already mentioned, dirt@showbizsandbox.com or 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. Like us, they have a website, whoismgmt.com. That's where they can be found. We can be found on showbizsandbox.com. Michael Giltz can be found every week at some new and exciting website. What is it this week?
I forget. I forgot. I forgot to make up a fake website name, .com.
Okay, well, you know, if you can't find Michael's very long domain name there, try finding some of his writing about the entertainment industry on the Huffington Post, or you can head on over to michaelgiltz.com for a complete, archive of all of his writing and work. You can also visit bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice.